The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue to read from the April and May 2022 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and we'll read an article today called Viking Village, text by Joshua Levine. A massive 1,100-year-old graveyard leads to a surprising new view of the Nordic legacy in Britain. Cat Jarman led me through a dense tangle of forest called Heath Wood. We were in Derbyshire, close to the very heart of England. There was no path, and the forest floor was overgrown with bracken and bush. It was easy to lose your footing, and even easier to lose your way. Jarman, a fit, cheery woman in her late 30s, plunged jauntily on as I tried to keep up. "See all these lumps and bumps?" she asked as we broke into a small clearing. She pointed to an array of 59 small, rounded hillocks, many 2 or so feet high and 4 or 5 feet in diameter. Humans, not nature, had clearly put these things here, and they gave off a spooky, supernatural energy. We are literally walking across a Viking cemetery, the only known Scandinavian cremation cemetery in the whole country, says Jarman, an archaeologist whose new book, River Kings, takes a fresh look at who the Vikings really were and what exactly they were up to here. She flashes me a broad smile. "It's very good, isn't it?" "Yes, it is good. Simple, powerful, and mysterious. For a ceremonial burial place, the Vikings picked a surprisingly unceremonial spot. The overgrown forest shrouds these tombs in anonymity. There is no visible sign of a Viking settlement nearby, just an expanse of open fields, and beyond that, a hamlet with a church, school, and a few houses. The Vikings used rivers to get around, but it's an awfully long hike from here to where the River Trent flows today. Which raises a big question," says Jarman. "Why have you got these Scandinavian cremation mounds here in the middle of nowhere?" Jarman thinks she finally found the answer, but only after new research techniques, changing attitudes, and some good luck filled in numerous blanks. 1,000 years ago, Heath Wood was likely bare of trees and could be seen from all around. The Trent flowed close by back then. LIDAR satellite imagery now reveals how dramatically the river has shifted its course in the past 1,000 years. And the empty fields around the foremark have been transformed by scholarship into the likely site of a Viking settlement. The men and women who lived there may have come with the Viking Great Army around AD 873, but they didn't all leave when the army moved on. They stayed and sank roots in England. In general, apart from stone sculptures and place names, the Vikings have left us little record of their 250-year moment on the stage of English history, roughly from the end of the 8th century to the middle of the 11th. Scholars are left to pick over some old bones, sometimes burnt and sometimes not, and the useful objects that accompanied their owners into the hereafter, what archaeologists call grave goods. The Vikings also left silver coins and jewelry, sometimes buried for later retrieval and known as a hoard, or, far more often, scattered haphazardly across the fields where they await the amateur metal detectorist's electromagnetic pulse. That's pretty much it. The Vikings left no contemporaneous written record, and later Icelandic sagas, while gripping, are uncertain guides. The Vikings likely did construct dwellings in England, but most of the buildings in that period, other than churches, were built out of wood, like the timber halls with Scandinavian ornament depicted in the movies The Lord of the Rings. "We don't have them," says Julian Richards, an archaeologist and co-author with Don Hadley of the 2021 book The Viking Great Army and the Making of England. It draws new conclusions from findings at Torski, where the Vikings spent the winter of 872 to 873 before marching south to Repton and likely Foremark and Heathwood. It seems Vikings are everywhere these past few years, and why not? Who doesn't love these hairy men as huge as sin with horned heads, as the Victorian poet G.K. Chesterton disparagingly called them? They teamed through Bernard Cornwell's best-selling book series, The Saxon Tales, and the TV series based on the novels, The Last Kingdom. They swarm over the English countryside in 89 episodes of the History Channel series Vikings. What you often get in these red meat extravaganzas is a bunch of Thor-happy thugs. The shout goes up, "Shield wall!" and we see them prepare to slaughter the hapless Anglo-Saxons who never seem to know what hit them. But the Vikings are also coming back to a richer, more nuanced life and a surge of scholarship by people like Jarman and Richards. It has begun picking apart the classical narrative of the Vikings in England, the account that casts the Vikings as interlopers who strutted their noisy hour upon the stage and disappeared from English history without a trace. I would say the change in perception is quite revolutionary, says Richards. Don't expect to find Eric the Pussycat at the end of this new research. The Viking job description always included violent combat and pillaging, but the new model Viking had considerably more on his mind than plunder. There was also trade and craft and urban development and language. Instead of waiting out the Vikings until they went away, the Anglo-Saxons reaped the myriad benefits of a broad cultural intermingling that many people still think never happened. The world turned empty where they trod, wrote Chesterton. Not so, says Jarman and Richards. The Northmen, and as we're coming to know women, made as indelible and lasting a contribution to English identity as the Anglo-Saxons. That's a controversial position to take out in these days of Brexit. The national myth of Alfred the Great and Anglo-Saxon triumphalism will not go away quietly. All archaeological and historical interpretation is politicized in a sense. We are writing in the moment, says Richard. Don and I have always been keen in our work to say that we shouldn't be oversimplifying identity. It pains to emphasize the contribution of racial mixing and movement. Starting in 1998, Richards was part of a team that opened some of the barrows in the Viking burial ground of Heathwood. This wasn't the first excavation of those mounds. A small number were dug up in the mid-19th century and again in the mid-20th century. Those digs unearthed objects such as sword blades and sword fragments that pointed to the 9th or 10th century and suggested Scandinavian origins but couldn't be confirmed. More was revealed when Richards and other members of his team opened three additional mounds. One contained the charred ash and bone of two bodies, an adult, possibly a woman, and a youth, who might be a young warrior or even a child. It could be the case of a female slave buried with her young master. Such grim ceremonies were recounted in the old annals. Or it could be a female warrior. Recent finds in Scandinavia now make this a more plausible hypothesis. We just don't know. A cow jaw was found as well. A remnant from a ritual feast? A sacrifice? We can't say. But Richards and his colleagues established for the first time that these were indeed late 9th or early 10th century Vikings. Some were cremated on the spot where they were found, while others were cremated elsewhere and transported. Both practices were common. Oh, they found horse bones too, Viking horses, according to isotope analysis. Whoever these Vikings were, they brought their horses to England. That was an important discovery. The story of the Vikings in England is generally held to start on June 8, 793, when a raiding party landed on the tidal island of Lindisfarne in Northumbria. As the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, the survey of English history written in the late 9th century, records, the harrowing inroads of heathen men made lamentable havoc in the Church of God on Holy Island by plunder and slaughter. Lindisfarne established a pattern of Viking hit-and-run raids in the summer months, but by the 850s, some of these raiders were choosing to overwinter in England. And then everything changed, decidedly for the worse if you were Anglo-Saxon. In 865, the great heathen army, translated from Misael hyphen here in Old English, landed in East Anglia, the small Anglo-Saxon kingdom on England's north coast. No one knows precisely how great it was or what kind of army was meant by the Old English word here. The questions still puzzle archaeologists, but whatever its precise dimensions, this army was a new and terrifying force. The great army spent the next 10 years causing havoc up and down the four Anglo-Saxon kingdoms of East Anglia, Wessex, Mercia, and Northumbria. Its aim was conquest, not plunder. They entered treaties, deposed kings, and installed puppets, and in general made life miserable for the people of what was to become England. The village of Repton, some 2.5 miles up the road from Heathwood, is a leafy hamlet in what was once the powerful kingdom of Mercia. The Repton School, founded in 1557, educated such pillars of Englishness as the actor Basil Rathbone and the Olympic sprinter Harold Abrams, an inspiration for the film Chariots of Fire. The lovely church of St. Wyston's, with its simple spire, casts a medieval glow over the countryside. The crypt behind the church goes back even further to the 8th century. Here were buried the kings of Mercia, Æthelbald and Wiglaf, and also Wiglaf's grandson, St. Wigstan, also spelled Winston, who gave his name to the church. In the 9th century, it was a place of pilgrimage and power. In 1974, the archaeologist Martin Biddle and his wife, Berthe Colby Biddle, began digging around the old crypt of St. Wyston's in search of the church's Anglo-Saxon roots. Several years later, we said, well, why don't we do some digging outside, Martin Biddle told me. There was this extraordinary mound in the vicar's garden, and we thought we'd better have a look. That brought us face to face with the Viking presence. The rest is history. The entry for the year 874 in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle reads, this year went the great army from Lindsay to Repton, and there took up winter quarters, drove the king, Bwred, over sea, and subdued all the land. It looked to everyone like the Biddles had come across the Viking winter camp. Another church, they found a broad, semicircular ditch forming a D-shaped enclosure. They were similar to defensive structures discovered in Scandinavia. In the vicarage garden, the Biddles found a shallow mound with the bones of 264 bodies. The Biddles also discovered a double grave containing the skeletons of two men. The pair, labeled Warrior 511 and Warrior 295, have become the most celebrated dead Vikings in England, but nobody knew who they were. Warrior 511, recently determined to be between 35 and 45 years old, had met the kind of death in battle that Vikings are always saying they want. A battle axe sliced through his left side, most likely lopping off his left testicle and penis before leaving a deep gash in his left femur. He may have been brought here from elsewhere, no one knows where exactly, and buried with everything he would need for a healthy Viking afterlife in Valhalla. A silver hammer of Thor pendant, a sword, two daggers, buckles and hasps for fastening clothing. A boar's tusk lay near his pelvis, which archaeologists such as Jarman think they stood in for 511's missing penis. Jarman first came on the scene in 2011 as an archaeology student, and she has been digging here off and on ever since. Years after the Biddles first found it, the Repton site has raised so many questions as it has answered. For starters, if the great army is so great, accounts from the period put its number in the thousands, how come the D-shaped enclosure is so small? You will be hard-pressed to house a street gang in it. Isotope dating studies of the bodies in the vicarage charnel mound found wide disparities. While many remains clearly dated to the period when the great army passed through, others seem to come from much earlier. What were they doing there? And perhaps less important to scholars, but at least as intriguing to the likes of you and me, who might Warrior 511 and Warrior 295 have been, and what were they doing sharing a grave? Jarman was showing me the place where the two warriors were found. The grass had grown back over their tomb in the shadow of St. Wyston's. In the vicarage garden, the bodies in the charnel mound have gone back to sleep. But in new trenches in the garden, Jarman's hunt for broader evidence of the Great Army's presence here continues. Repton is still open for business. Jarman recently found weapon fragments and ship's nails. Martin Biddle is a fantastic archaeologist, but it's a very complicated set of excavations, so work is still ongoing 40 years later, says Jarman. In 2018, Jarman published a study of the inconsistent radiocarbon dates among the bones in the garden. Jarman argued that the discrepancy could be explained by different diets of the people whose bones were radiocarbon dated. Carbon from the sea circulates for 400 years on average before it enters the food chain, far longer than carbon from the atmosphere. As a result, the bones of people who primarily eat fish appear in tests to be considerably older than the bones of people who primarily eat meat, which absorbs the carbon from the atmosphere. After correcting for what is called the marine reservoir effect, Jarman found that all the bones dated from roughly the same period, the time when the Great Army wintered in Repton. Jarman thinks she may have put names to the two warriors, too. Her isotope analysis of the warriors' teeth has already told her they both came from somewhere in the south of Scandinavia, probably Denmark. She then collaborated with geneticists at the University of California, Santa Cruz, to extract and analyze DNA extracted from teeth and bone. Using very recent techniques to investigate both maternal and paternal DNA, Jarman determined that the pair were first-degree relatives, and most likely father and son. From there, she combed the annals for references to Vikings' fathers and sons raiding in the British Isles around that time. Bingo! The Annals of Ulster tells of a Viking king named Amleib, also known as Olaf, who raided in Ireland and Britain in the years after 853. Olaf was killed fighting the Picts in Scotland in 874, which drives with a return to Repton for burial. Moreover, Olaf had a son named Einstein, or Oynstein, who, according to the Ulster Annals, was deceitfully killed by Alban, often identified as Halfdan. The Halfdan turns out to be one of the Great Army's four leaders at Repton. It's far from proof positive, but the two famous warriors are no longer just numbers. Jarman has managed to give them plausible names and backstories. If the Great Army couldn't all fit in St. Wyston's churchyard, they must have gone elsewhere. Where did they go? The answers may lie down the road from Repton in Foremark, the area beside the isolated Viking cemetery in Heathwood. In 2017, Jarman was a guest on a BBC TV broadcast called Digging for Britain. Jarman's breezy, unpedantic manner has made her a popular interview subject. When I was doing the program, I tweeted a picture of Foremark, and somebody tweeted back to me and said, "Oh, my mate metal detects around there, and he's always finding really brilliant Viking artifacts," Jarman recalls. This was a windfall. Jarman had been trying for years to work with local metal detectorists and getting nowhere. "We know that people metal detect around here, but nobody has ever reported anything Viking, which is bizarre," says Jarman. "No one was willing to talk to me. It was really difficult." In general, there is little love between detectorists and archaeologists. Since the 1970s, England and Wales have seen an explosion in metal detecting as a hobby. There are now about 20,000 amateur detectorists who turn up all kinds of things, including much of what the Vikings dropped. The trouble is, many detectorists, instead of donating their finds to scholarship, would rather sell them on the sly. Archaeologists refer to such opportunists as nighthawks. In 1996, England passed the Treasure Act, which makes it illegal to sell objects that are at least 300 years old with over 10% gold or silver content. The odd coin is exempt. A year later, England and Wales created a voluntary database called the Portable Antiquities Scheme, PAS, to log disparate finds not covered by the Treasure Act, a brooch here, a pendant there. These two mechanisms, the Treasure Act and the PAS, haven't worked flawlessly. Skullduggery persists. In 2019, two detectorists were sentenced to long prison terms for secretly trafficking the Leominster hoard, a dazzling trove of Viking jewelry and coins they had found in a town near Hereford. Most of the hoard has vanished into private hands, a terrible loss to history. But in the main, the carrot and stick of the PAS and Treasure Act have worked to coax out the profusion of Viking objects that otherwise might never have surfaced, particularly in the past 5 to 10 years. Says Julian Richards, "The logging and recording of finds through the PAS has opened huge research avenues in the UK, whereas previously a lot of archaeologists were very concerned about metal detecting." The detectorist who contacted Kat Jarman after her TV broadcast had not reported his finds to the PAS, but he was happy to show her where he discovered in the fields of Foremark below Heathwood. The heaps of coins, Thorhammer pendants, and lead gaming pieces were the link Jarman had been searching for. "Here was all the missing stuff we didn't have before," says Jarman. "Repton's army came into focus. I think some of the army were in Repton, possibly guarding the main site and the valuable bits and pieces. And then you have the general riffraff, all the normal people up here. I think Foremark became a Viking settlement. We haven't found it yet because I suspect it's underneath a local school, which they haven't let me dig up yet. I'm working on it." A crucial part of that Viking settlement, says Jarman, was the graveyard atop Heath Wood. "I think it's staking a claim, as if to say this landscape and the whole location belongs to us, the Vikings. The standard narrative has been the army comes, the army leaves, and that's it. The end of the Repton story, 873 to 874. Jarman goes on, "That is what I don't agree with. This idea that the Vikings come and then they go is absolutely not the case. I think the Repton story is much longer than that." Jarman pointed me to an archaeologist named Jane Kershaw, whose recent works has given Jarman's ideas a considerable boost. Richard cites Kershaw too. For her PhD research, Kershaw surveyed the Scandinavian jewelry in the PAS database. As she did, she started noticing brooches and pendants that were identical to pieces she knew from Scandinavian museums, some with casting flaws indicating they came from the same master mold. For the most part, these were not finely crafted pieces made for the ruling elite. They were cheap, mass-produced ornaments for the more common folk. "The jewelry I found is being imported to England on the clothes of Scandinavian women. That means there will be children, too, in a whole family-based settlement structure," says Kershaw. "I argue that what we have here are whole family groups migrating from Denmark to England in the wake of the Great Army. It's not a single blip either. It starts in the late 9th century and continues for 50 to 75 years as the jewelry styles in England keep up with the changing fashions in Scandinavia. We tend to think of the Vikings as looting and taking treasure away with them. Actually, what they're doing is bringing silver in as jewelry and coins. They're bringing wealth into the country, which probably helps fuel the rise of towns. At Torksey, Julian Richards and Don Hadley arrived at the same inconvenient truth by a different path. Torksey, which was then part of Mercia, is where the Viking Great Army overwintered in 872 to 873 before moving down to Repton the next year. We know this from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. What Richards and Hadley found there convinced them that the Great Army was indeed great, possibly numbering as many as 5,000 people. Our work at Torksey suggests that the Great Army was akin to a town on the move, they write in their new book. The arrival of such a large population must have been the catalyst for urban development in numerous places. Back in the 1960s, an archaeologist named Maurice Barley had led students to Torksey on almost a decade of summer digs. They were looking for the town's medieval ancestors. Among other things, they came across six ancient clay kilns and some pottery shards, perhaps produced by Torksey's Anglo-Saxon residents. Richards Hadley and the pottery specialist named Gareth Perry had their doubts. Perry took local clay samples, ran his own pottery-making experiments, and figured out how and, more important, when the Torksey ware was made. It was sophisticated, produced on an industrial scale, and bore no resemblance to Anglo-Saxon styles and methods. The finds were eye-opening, Richards and Hadley say. For one thing, there were many more kilns in the area than Barley had found. Moreover, the initial dates of Torksey's pottery production corresponded to the period when the Great Army passed through. And while Scandinavia itself produced nothing like Torksey ware, regions under Viking influence in Northern Europe did. Richards and Hadley believed that the Great Army brought European potters with them to England. Remnants of that army, including some of those potters, stayed on, assimilated and spurred the industrial growth of their adopted homeland. Obviously, we present the impact of Vikings in England in the 9th century as a positive thing, says Richards. It leads to a lot of things that did have a lasting impact. Even if the Great Army weren't directly responsible for it, they acted as a catalyst. After Torksey and Repton, the Great Army split up, never to regroup, as a military unit. A Viking chieftain named Halfdan, the punitive murderer of Warrior 295, led his warriors north into Northumbria, where they formed part of a larger Viking zone in England known as the Danelaw. Meanwhile, the chieftains Guthrum, Ulstetel, and Ondwend led their warriors to East Anglia and then into Wessex, the only one of the four Anglo-Saxon kingdoms to hold off the Vikings. Here, history collides with myth, and myth wins. As every English schoolchild knows, Alfred, King of Wessex, resists the Danes, gets whipped, regroups from his marshy redoubt, and unites Wessex to beat the Vikings at the Battle of Edington in 878. England's origin myth starts here, with all its binary vigor. Anglo-Saxons good, Vikings bad. This is not the place to take potshots at the Alfred legend. There are good reasons Alfred is one of the only English kings with a great after his name. It was attached to him in the 16th century. But by all accounts, Alfred was a remarkable man and, yes, a great king. It's not unimportant, however, that these accounts begin with the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and the life of Alfred, written by Alfred's handpicked biographer, Bishop Asser. Objectivity is not their hallmark. The Chronicle is written in a monastery in Wessex from the perspective of bigging up Alfred and his battle against those horrendous Vikings. That builds up his claim to the whole country, said Kat Jarman. Those accounts have been the Bible for studying Vikings. A lot of people still use it as the rule book instead of saying, okay, what's literally on the ground? What does the archaeology say? British screenwriter and producer Michael Hirst, who wrote the successful Vikings TV series, also spent time digging with Jarman in the Repton Vicarage Garden. The whole subject of Vikings is one of those things you know something about and you realize you know absolutely nothing, Hirst told me. One of the things the series is doing is trying to overcome centuries of prejudice and ignorance about Vikings and their culture. Little Englanders and nationalists are my bête noire. I hate that. We are still Vikings. They're embedded in our culture. It's about time people woke up to that. Next, we'll move on to an article in The Past is Prologue, titled Survivor, The True Meaning of Our National Symbol, by Jack E. Davis. In a letter to his daughter not long after the United States won its independence, Benjamin Franklin branded the bald eagle a bird of bad moral character. He wished, he wrote, that it had not been chosen as the representative of our country. Many believe that he also lobbied for the turkey as a national bird. That's not true, however. In fact, Congress has never chosen a national bird, as it has a national mammal, the bison, and the national tree, the oak. What the Continental Congress did was put the bald eagle on the Great Seal of the United States in 1782. Long venerated by native cultures, Halitus lucephalus lives only in North America, a distinction that suited a young republic eager to assert an American-born identity separate from Europe. Ever since, the bald eagle has reigned as a symbol of national unity and strength. Once a fixture across the country, the persecuted bird began disappearing from an increasing number of states. Of the millions of people who daily see our national emblem on coins and arms of our country, Nature magazine wrote in 1923, a very large proportion have never seen an American eagle in the sky. In 1940, a year before declaring war against fascist tyranny, Congress passed the Bald Eagle Protection Act to preserve a symbol of the American ideals of freedom. Harming an eagle now brought fines and a prison sentence. Yet 5 years later, when eagles were poised for recovery, DDT became available for general use. Collateral victims of the pesticide's widespread application included countless fish and birds, and by 1963, the bald eagle's nesting population in the contiguous U.S. has fallen to despairing 487 pairs, far fewer than what a single state would have hosted before the revolution. At the same time, Americans had fouled their nest. Biocides tainted their food, factory and automobile exhaust their air, and waste products their water. Recognizing that their quality of life, even survival, depended on the same healthy environments that non-human species required, 20 million Americans nationwide participated in cleanup and tree planting campaigns and protest marches on the first Earth Day, April 22, 1970. Congress responded in swift order with a series of landmark environmental laws, including the Clean Air Act and the Endangered Species Act. In just 1 year, 1972, the EPA banned the use of DDT, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service imposed harsh penalties for harming eagles, and Congress gave decisive bipartisan support to the Clean Water Act. Marking its 50th anniversary this October, the CWA initiated revitalization of our rivers, lakes, and coastal waters, the majority of which were unsafe for fishing and swimming. Nothing would be more essential to the eagle's comeback than the CWA restoring their watery habitats. While more than a third of the world's national animals, from India's tigers to Tanzania's Maasai giraffes, are endangered, bald eagles are thriving. During the 2010s, their population quadrupled, reaching roughly 300,000 in the contiguous U.S., equivalent to the estimated number in the 18th century. America's bird has become a symbol of society that has forged a wiser balance between nature and more secure future for humankind. Bald eagles have not changed since the adoption of the Great Seal. They have shown us that we can change. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. I wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919. Thank you for listening.